Okay, phone lines are already jammed. Lynn Marzulli, our guest, will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, very good. To the phones we go. Wildcard line, Bruce in San Jose, California. Hey, Bruce, thanks for calling.
Hey, George. Yeah. First, I wanted to say that Lynn's new book is outstanding. I've read it, and it has a big finale at the end.
Thanks, Bruce. Appreciate that.
The big finale.
Welcome back to the big finale. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, if you're keeping score at home, maybe you have a giant scorecard on your living room wall, tacked there by tiny thumbtacks, you know that this is episode 13. Now, for some people, episode 13 might sound a little bit unlucky if you're superstitious. Of course, we're not superstitious here at the big finale. And we've got a great episode for you this week. We have an author, Dennis Brooks, who talks about his new book, Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods. Now, of course, this book is about Atlantis, and we haven't done a show yet on the topic of Atlantis here on the big finale. So we're doing it this week. Now, before we go on, I just wanted to remind you that for those of you who may not know, of course, this program, The Big Finale, airs every Monday night at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on IPBN-FM.com. We also have another show, The Bruce Collins Show. Now, The Bruce Collins Show airs on Thursday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on WWPR, 1490 a.m. in the Tampa-Bradenton area. You can also listen to that online. But this show, the Bruce Collins Show, also airs on Friday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern Time right here at IPBN-FM.com. Both the Big Finale and the Bruce Collins Show are on the Bruce Collins Show channel on YouTube. So you can get all of these programs on YouTube at the Bruce Collins Show channel. And we would really appreciate it if you're able to subscribe to the Bruce Collins Show channel. We would love it. Now, up next, we have Dennis Brooks talking about Atlantis. And then later, we'll delve deeper into the topic of Atlantis.
How much of a geek are you? No, seriously, do you think you're a Star Wars expert? Well, take the hardest Star Wars quiz in the world and find out. Go to zippycheese.com and see how well you know the Star Wars movies. There's a quiz for the original trilogy, or, if you dare, take the quiz for the prequel trilogy. What's the name of the creature in the trash compactor in Episode 4? What was the name of the curator of the Jedi Archives in Episode 2? Go to zippycheese.com, take the quiz, and share with your friends. There's also a Marvel comic book quiz. Do you know obscure Marvel comic book characters? We'll find out today. That's zippycheese.com.
And joining me this week is Dennis Brooks. Dennis Brooks was a military instructor and training developer for the U.S. Army for 20 years. When he retired, he started working as a teacher's assistant and returned to college to get a bachelor's degree in biology. Since then, he has worked as a teacher. Mr. Brooks is the author of Atlantis Conspiracy, Triple Double Speed Reading, Breaking with Dyslexia, and Early Reading Skills. His latest book is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White, again by Dennis Brooks. You can find his books online at Amazon.com and Lulu.com. Dennis Brooks, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Bruce. It's good to be on.
Well, it's great to have you on. Now, this is a fascinating book, Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White, again by Dennis Brooks. Dennis, how did this book come about?
I started working on this book after I found that the Florida plane matched the description Plato gave as the plane of Atlantis. Since then, I have been looking for other ways to connect Atlantis to the Americas. I have written a series of books on Atlantis since I started. This is the latest book in the series. It has new discoveries, ancient stories, and new terrain features that help tell the story. I believe that with enough interest in this subject, credibility may return to Atlantis as a topic of research.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And again, the book is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White by Dennis Brooks. And this book is available on Amazon.com and also Lulu.com. Now, Dennis, what is it about Atlantis that compels you personally to study and write about it?
The story is fascinating and believable. It is believable because I can match the continent of Atlantis to North America. The evidence is irrefutable. It is fascinating because it started with Solon, one of the seven wise men of Greece. He was also a political leader and traveler. According to Plato, Solon learned of Atlantis from Egyptian priests. In the latter part of the 6th century BCE, Solon left Athens and traveled to Sais, Egypt. During his time in Egypt, Solon wrote the story of Atlantis. He was allowed to go into the sacred temples there and record where the records was kept. With their help, with help from the priests, he recorded the information from their history books. Solon left Egypt and took the story back to Athens in the form of a manuscript. When Solon died, he left the manuscript with his relatives. It was then handed down from relative to relative until Plato recorded and published the story in a dialogue. Plato said that he was recording lost history, and I believed him.
Hmm. That's interesting. I knew about Plato, but I didn't know the whole backstory. That's fascinating. Now, Dennis, what are some of the reasons you believe Atlantis was real?
I believe it was real because the story of Atlantis keeps popping up to account for many strange and unexplained findings. This includes the pyramids of Egypt and the ancient copper mines in Wisconsin and Michigan. America's ancient history includes evidence of European visitors before Columbus. Artifacts show that the Vikings visited America and stayed a while. Large sculptures indicate that Africans were present in South America. In addition, private museums all over the United States have collections of out-of-place, unexplained artifacts found by pioneer settlers. This includes thousands of metal objects such as knives, spear points, tools, and weapons of all shapes and sizes. The ancient harbor near Bimini Island in the Bahamas is also related to Atlantis.
Hmm. Now, again, the book is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White by Dennis Brooks. Now, what was life like for those who lived in Atlantis?
Well, Plato told us a little about the people, little bits and pieces here and there. And here is his description. The people used whatever fragrant things they found and grew. This included roots, herbage, woods, and essences, which they distilled from fruit and flowers. That sacred island continent brought forth fair and wondrous resources in infinite abundance. According to Plato, there was an abundance of wood for carpenter work and enough for the maintenance and for the people and the wild animals. This included a great number of elephants on the continent. Now, these elephants probably were the mastodons or mammoths. The people went on constructing their temples and palaces and harbors and docks. Now, from this description, we can assume that they were ordinary people, just like you and me.
Mm-hmm. Now, what caused Atlantis to be destroyed?
It seems that the destruction of Atlantis was the result of a natural disaster that I call the Carolina Event. This was a shower of comet fragments that hit the Earth about 11,600 years ago. The larger comet broke up into 500,000 fragments and hit the Earth. The impacts triggered earthquakes and forest fires throughout the Americas and other parts of the world. Evidence of the cataclysm is permanently etched into the landscape, giving us a record of the event. The fragments dug a series of elliptical craters across North America, which are now called Carolina Bays. These craters are concentrated along the Atlantic seaboard within Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, Florida, and as far away as Nebraska. In Maryland, they are called Maryland Basin. Fragments also landed in Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico, and the Atlantic Ocean, causing what we now call the Great Flood.
Hmm. Fascinating. Again, the author is Dennis Brooks. We're speaking to him this week, and the book is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods. Now, your book, this is interesting. Your book makes a Atlantis-Egypt connection. What is the Atlantis-Egypt connection?
Well, when the comet fragments hit, they landed in the ocean and created tsunamis. So the tsunamis from this Carolina event flooded the Mediterranean basin. It went through the Straits of Gibraltar and flooded the basin. The waves overran the banks and submerged the pyramids. The water kept going out into the desert. When it receded back toward the ocean, it took tons of debris from the desert and deposited it along the way. This water left tons of sediment around the base of the pyramids, where archaeologists found silt 14 feet deep. This material from the ocean and desert left behind its unique signature, which is traceable by science. The silt contains many seashells and fossils that have been radiocarbon dated to be 11,600 years old. To see evidence of the Great Flood, all you have to do is look at the top of the largest pyramid. A cap on the top of this pyramid is the high water mark for the flood. This evidence alone dates the flood and the destruction of Atlantis. Also, when the Great Pyramid was first opened, incrustations of salt, 1 inch thick, were found inside it. Chemical analysis has shown that the salt has a mineral content consistent with water from the ocean. This is further evidence that the pyramids were submerged by flood water from the ocean.
Hmm. Now, your book, Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, it makes an interesting tie to Mexico, of all things. So talk about the Atlantis ties to Mexico.
Well, getting away from Plato and going into another book, which you can find, and this information is in my book. Mm-hmm. According to an old book called Our Story of Atlantis by Dr. W.P. Phelan, Florida was the great city of Atlantis, and the Yucatan Peninsula held the grand city of Atlantis. In other words, Mexico City was the city of Atlantis at the time of its destruction. This book gives detailed information about four areas and their terrain features. Three of them are temples, and one is the king's palace in Mexico City. While the palace is no longer there, two temples are still standing and can be identified on the map by terrain features in the surrounding area. The book provided valuable information that helped to identify and verify details about Atlantis. Without our story of Atlantis, it would be difficult to connect the pyramids of Egypt to those found in Mexico. Also, Dr. Phelan's book reinforces Plato's story, and Plato's story reinforces Dr. Phelan's book. Neither of the stories would be believable without the actual terrain features and structures the books describe.
Here's my tie to Atlantis. When I was a kid, my mom took us to this, I think it was summer movie festival. And these were like dollar movies, which at the time was, you know, probably the price was about right. They were old movies that they were showing for kids to go to. And one of the movies that summer was about Atlantis. And I forget what the name of the movie is, but it's a pretty well-known Atlantis movie. And very, very interesting. And ever since then, I've always thought about it. And this book is a great book, Atlantis Pyramids Floods by Dennis Brooks. I think you're going to find a lot of great information in this book. Again, it's Atlantis Pyramids Floods, and you can go to Amazon.com or Lulu.com and order it there. Now, and you can also get it as an ebook, by the way, on Amazon for your Kindle. Now, you also have a chapter that talks about Edgar Cayce. Can you talk about Edgar Cayce and his contribution to the Atlantis story?
Yeah, I'll talk about Edgar Cayce just briefly because what he said, he talked about it a lot during his readings, but and I'll just go to one of the most important things he talked about. Edgar Cayce said that portions of Atlantis would rise again and that we could expect it to happen in 1968 and 1969. Well, that prediction did come true, but no one noticed it. I'll tell you why. While researchers were searching around Bimini, where they thought Atlantis was, a small island in Tampa, Florida, rose and became usable land again. It is now Harbor Island in Tampa, Florida. It is not circular, it's triangular. See, most people got this story of Atlantis as the island being circular with three moats around it. It's actually triangular, and you have to reread this Plato description to realize that.
That's interesting. Now, you mentioned this before, but maybe touch on it again. How does Florida state soil become part of your book on Atlantis? What's the connection?
Well, it's a long story, but I'm going to give you just a little brief part of it here. Mm-hmm. According to this book, Our Story of Atlantis, the whole Yucatan Peninsula and the state of Florida was leveled and covered with a white pavement by the people of Atlantis. Now, that's incredible. Mm-hmm. But you can see this. It doesn't take much to see this special soil even now. Simply search the Internet and look at simply search the Internet maps. Zoom in and look at the ground cover in Florida and the Yucatan. You can see the white pavement everywhere, especially on the beaches. This pavement covers the shorelines from Florida to the southern shores of Mexico. Florida has now claimed this as its state soil. It is also why ancient texts refer to Atlantis as the White Island.
Now, I saw a section in your book that talked about Hebrew artifacts. Are there any Atlantis ties to Hebrew artifacts?
Well, there are ties to it because I've tied them together with my research. And you know, this is another one of the strange pieces you're going to run into in the book there. But it's it it, 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 it It has been explained much more clearly in the book than this little brief section I'm going to give you here. Many artifacts bearing Hebrew inscription have been found in the United States, but for the most part, they have been dismissed as fakes because they were found by farmers, construction workers, and other non-archaeologists. The findings that stand out are those that cannot be disputed. And here's one example, the Los Lunas inscription. Near Los Lunas, New Mexico, at the base of Mystery Mountain, is one of the world's most interesting historical mysteries. A boulder holds the Los Lunas inscription. It was once thought to be a combination of Greek, Hebrew, and Phoenician characters. There were many attempts at decoding it when it was first found, but no one got it right. Finally, when the Hebrew writing was decoded, scholars found that the stone preserved an abbreviated form of the Ten Commandments, making it clearly Semitic in origin. So, you know, that's a huge mystery, and it takes a lot to explain that.
Yeah. Again, the book we're speaking about is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White by Dennis Brooks. Now, what about DNA, Dennis? Can DNA help us connect a race or people to Atlantis?
Well, yeah, they tried DNA, and they were really surprised at the results. In an attempt to prove that Native Americans arrived in America by traveling across a narrow land bridge from Siberia, researchers used DNA to try to search for the trail of the travelers who first came to America. The genetic marker they chose for the research is called haplogroup X. Some scientists have estimated that people arrived in America with this genetic marker between 12,000 and 36,000 years ago. Naturally, they expected to find the marker among the people of Asia. However, they have not been able to find the haplogroup X among the people in Mongolia or Siberia. In 2009, when the origin of haplogroup X was found and revealed, it turned out to be a Eurasian marker from the hills of Galilee. This raised the possibility among researchers that some Native Americans must have been of Caucasian and Jewish ancestry.
In your book, the title of your book is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White. So the question is, why are Europeans white?
Well, you know, if you want to get the simple answer, you can go on the Internet and they'll give you the simple answer. But they don't give you the reason why. They don't give you the story behind it. And here's the story behind it. During the Great Flood, and this was the same flood that destroyed Atlantis, during the Great Flood, all the low-lying areas, including those around the United Kingdom, Spain, France, Italy, Greece, and Turkey, were underwater. Also, all the coastal areas around the Black Sea were flooded. Hundreds of millions of people died in 2 days because of this flooding. This sudden disaster erased the people who made up the brown skin color gradient, leaving only blacks in Africa and whites in Europe. This included the people in the Ukraine, Romania, Hungary, and Poland. Now, according to this new theory, periodic flooding of the Mediterranean basin destroys the region that separates the blacks and whites. The last flooding was caused by the Carolina event 11,600 years ago. And that was the same event that destroyed Atlanta. So by the last 50,000 years, there might have been five floodings of the Mediterranean basin. So this is the Great Flood. This is Noah's Great Flood. Mm-hmm. Now Plato said, and if you read carefully in Plato's story of Atlantis, he mentions that the flooding has occurred several times. So this is not something that's new to him.
Yeah. Your latest book is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White, again by Dennis Brooks. And you can find out, you can go to Amazon.com and also Lulu.com and order this book, Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods by Dennis Brooks. But people might be interested in your other book, too, which is called Atlantis Conspiracy. How are these two books different? If someone wanted to pick up a copy of Atlantis Conspiracy, how is that different from Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods?
The new book includes everything that's in the old book.
Oh, I see.
So it's outdated.
Mm-hmm.
So the best is just go ahead and get the Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White, because it doesn't tell anything about the flooding of the Mediterranean basin and stuff like that. So the latest book is the best book. It's an upgrade.
Mm-hmm. So again, the book is Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods, Why Europeans Are White by Dennis Brooks. And you can get it on Amazon.com or Lulu.com. Dennis, this has been awesome. Thank you so much. This has been a really interesting look at Atlantis, and I know people are going to enjoy your book, Atlantis, Pyramids, Floods. Thank you so much for joining us this week, Dennis.
Well, thank you, Bruce. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Great.
How much of a geek are you? No, seriously, do you think you're a Star Wars expert? Well, take the hardest Star Wars quiz in the world and find out. Go to zippycheese.com and see how well you know the Star Wars movies. There's a quiz for the original trilogy, or, if you dare, take the quiz for the prequel trilogy. What's the name of the creature in the trash compactor in Episode 4? What was the name of the curator of the Jedi Archives in Episode 2? Go to zippycheese.com, take the quiz, and share with your friends. There's also a Marvel comic book quiz. Do you know obscure Marvel comic book characters? We'll find out today. That's zippycheese.com.
I'm very excited this week. We're going to be talking about the publication Lost Secrets of the Gods, a new book that is coming out this month, July, and it's for lovers of ancient history and unsolved mysteries of centuries past. We have some great authors that have contributed to this book: Jim Mars, Nick Redfern, Micah Hanks, Frank Joseph, Scott Allen Roberts, Paul Vaughn Ward, and many more have contributed to this anthology, and it reveals new evidence and discoveries that will thrill their vast readers, armies of readers. Now, our guest this week is Frank Joseph, and we've had him several times. You can go into our archive at fringeradionetwork.com and find some past interviews with Frank Joseph where we've talked about many other topics of archaeology and history. Frank has authored more books about the lost civilization of Atlantis than any other writer in history. His complete published output includes 26 titles in as many foreign editions. He was the editor-in-chief of Ancient American, a popular science magazine, from its inception in 1993 until his retirement 14 years later. During his career as a staff reporter for other periodicals, Joseph interviewed the likes of Secretary of State John Kerry, Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, test pilot Chuck Yeager, and actors such as Peter Ustinov and Vincent Price. Today he is a feature writer for Atlantis Rising, as well as Australia's Nexus and New Dawn. An avid scuba diver since he was 17 years old, Frank has participated in hundreds
of underwater expeditions from the Eastern Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean off North Africa to the Bahamas and Polynesia. A professor of world archaeology at Japan Savant Society, his work has received award recognition from the Midwest Epigraphic Society, the Burroughs Cave Society, and the Ancient American Artifact Preservation Society. He lives today with his wife, Laura, and their Norwegian forest cat, Sammy, in the upper Mississippi Valley. Frank, Joseph, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Thank you so much, Bruce. It's great to be back.
Well, it's always an honor to have you on. And one thing that I like is we reveal new information that isn't privy to most people because we just don't see this in the history books. Now, this particular contribution is a chapter in the book Lost Secrets of the Gods, and there are other many interesting authors. Many of them are on this program periodically. For our listeners maybe that are getting into this topic for the first time, your chapter is Plato's Atlantis, Fact or Fiction. To the average listener, and maybe we could open this up to hidden history as part of that topic, but why is Atlantis important to our listeners?
Well, it's important because it was the first place where human beings made the transition from savagery to civilization, and that everything that we know about Atlantis indicates that it was the first modern civilization. It was incredibly similar to our own. And this is important because this was a society that rose to very high technological levels, very high levels of ideological and sociological golden age perfection, if you want to say that for a while, and then it entered into decline. They lost it. In other words, here was a people that achieved tremendous greatness, but they couldn't hold on to it. Why? What happened? The great value, the great utility of Atlantis is of a sociological nature. And that is, it holds the mirror up to our own civilization, which is so similar to it in so many ways. Our own civilization has achieved great levels of technological and, earlier of course, ideological greatness. We've gone through our own great, our own golden ages. And yet, we're living in a time now which some people regard as a period of very crucial change. Some people even describe it as a decline. If that's the case, then we are really close to Atlantean civilization. And if they lost, if the Atlanteans, who are so much like ourselves, if they lost their civilization, what mistakes did they make? Why did they self-destruct? They did self-destruct. What happened to them? And are we doing the same thing? This is the great utility of history, is that we have to learn from past mistakes. And so if Atlantis is a civilization which is so similar to our own and then made errors or mistakes that are similar to what we're doing, then it's very profitable for us to learn the parallels. It's a warning. I would say that the great value of Atlantis is a cautionary tale. It's a great warning. The Atlanteans themselves, would appear, never believed that their old civilization would ever collapse, that it would go on forever, generation after generation, as it had for thousands of years. It was much older. It lasted much longer than ours did. And yet they lost it. Something happened. It was utterly, totally destroyed. It was destroyed to the level that it was reduced. It was pummeled and crumpled to the point where it was reduced to a mere legend, a mere myth. And here was a real place, really existed, and yet most people regard it now just as a myth. And I think that would be the most disturbing to the spirits, as it were, of the Atlanteans, if they know or could come back, to think that this great culture, which played such a major role in history, is now even doubted that it even existed. I think we face the same type of challenge, and therein lies the real utility of Atlantis.
I remember when I was a youngster, maybe 6 or 7 years old, we had a corner matinee, and they had summer movies for, I think it was a doll or something like that, and they were older movies. They weren't first run movies, but they were for kids. And one of the movies was about Atlantis. I don't remember the title.
It's called The Lost Continent of Atlantis by George Pal.
Really?
Yes. So it was a feature film that came out around 1960, 1959, something like that. And it was one of the few feature films at that time that I think maybe it might have been the first feature film that was actually dramatized of the story of Atlantis. And of course, it was a dramatization and had some strange things in it. But generally speaking, in the general characterization of this place, it had a certain level of truth about it. Yeah.
Did
George Powell, of course, was the same producer who did War of the Worlds before that.
Yes. So this was the movie where the leader, I believe, had a crystal that could if the sun hit it, I think, it made a laser, something to that effect?
Right, uh-huh.
Okay, so that is the movie.
And, of course, Edgar Cayce, the great sleeping prophet of the 20th century, talked about just such a thing, as a matter of fact. The movie, Atlantis, the Lost Continent of Atlantis, I think it was called, by George Powell, that was based somewhat on Edgar Cayce's life readings. And Edgar Cayce said that the Atlanteans had crystal technology, which they were able to use to elevate their society higher above others. And that's not really so hard to believe, because look at what our civilization, our American society, is based on Silicon Valley. You know,
right.
It's our crystal technology. So he said they had something, a stone especially, a major one, called the Tuai Stone, T-U-A-O-I. I guess it's pronounced Tuai, I'm not sure. And the Tuai Stone was this great, Edgar Cayce, it was not too specific in describing it, saying that it just was a crystal that was able to harness energies and in such a way that they could use it for enhancing their economic development. That one day they had used it too aggressively, and Atlantis self-destroyed because in their greed, the Atlanteans used this Tuai Stone to make themselves more and more wealthy. And as it turns out, that they overdid it, and they self-destructed themselves. That's according to Cayce's story of Atlantis, and that was incorporated into the movie to some extent.
Fascinating. I'll have to rewatch that. Now, when you hear about Atlantis, when you're raised in the public schools and you hear about Atlantis, it's taught as a myth, and they say that Plato invented it. I would think that you disagree with that, and if so, how did he learn about Atlantis?
Well, to get to the second part of your question, first, I first developed an interest in Atlantis, I guess just like anybody else. I'd heard about it. I didn't know much about it. That's the thing about Atlantis, which is really interesting. Everybody's heard about it, but very few people know about it. And, this is about now 35 years ago, I guess. I just wandered into a bookstore. I had an extra $100. I don't think I've had an extra $100 since then, as a matter of fact. But anyway, I had an extra $100. I think I'm going to buy $100 worth of books on things that I don't know anything about. And one of the things that I saw, a book there called Atlantis and Other Lost Continents, I think, was by L. Sprague de Camp, was his name, who was a science writer, a wonderful science writer in the 1950s and 60s. And it was called Atlantis, I think, the Lost Continent, something like that. And I figured, well, this will just fill in some gaps of knowledge of mine. I'd heard about Atlantis as a myth, but didn't know anything more about it. And that really got me started, was L. Sprague de Camp's book on Lost Continents. I think that was the name of his Lost Continents. And the book, as I wrote to L. Sprague de Camp years later, I said, you know, this book that you wrote was great. It got me interested in it, but it provoked more questions than it answered. And so over the next several years, I began trying to answer some of these questions that he provoked. It made me very unsubtle. I thought, it's probably just a story, but there's got to be some basis to it. And that became a kind of an obsession, I admit. And so from about 1980, yeah, that's right, 1980 until now, this has been the leading interest in my life. And I have, like I said, I've published more books about Atlantis than anybody else in history now. That doesn't mean that they're the best books, but it means there are more than anybody else. And so that's what got me interested in it, I think, was L. Sprague de Camp's book.
Yeah.
Which provoked, like I say, more questions than it provided answers. And as far as Atlantis being a real place, It took me many years to make that transition. I went under the assumption, like everybody, that, oh, this is just a myth, but it's an interesting myth. It's an attractive myth. But boy, as I started collecting materials from other parts of the world, and then especially when I began traveling around the world, and I took several world trips specifically to find evidence that I could not obtain in the United States. And after years of traveling on my own nickel, I should admit, I piled up huge amounts of evidence. And this is the thing about Atlantis. This is the point that's brought me to now after all these years. The amount of evidence on behalf of Atlantis as a real place is so huge now. The body of evidence is so gigantic that it at least justifies a serious expedition to find this place. I mean, it really does, whether you believe in it or you don't. When you begin to grasp the magnitude of the proofs on behalf of this place, it justifies definitely a serious expedition. Now, I've got to the point in my life now, after nearly 35 years of research, that perhaps as a human being, I have made a mistake. I will freely admit that. I do believe personally that Atlantis was a real place. I think I know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, perhaps I have made a mistake. I've made an error, and my conclusions are incorrect. I will freely admit that. The only way to know for sure is to go out there and look for it. And that's what I'm attempting to do now after all these years. I hope I live long enough, I have enough years left, where I can actually try to find it. I think I have a generally good idea where it is. And I know that I'm trying to now get the proper procedures to actually find it, because Atlantis research has really reached as far as it can go at this point. Mm-hmm. And it's huge. As I say, it's gigantic, the amount of materials, of evidence available to anybody who wants to look in this. I mean, how many books have I written? I even forgot. I've written about a dozen books on Atlantis, and I try to put all the best evidence I can for it. It's gigantic. But nobody knows unless there's physical proof. I'm the first to admit that there is no physical proof for the existence of Atlantis. No one has yet found a sign saying Atlantis city limits. But I believe that such a thing, comparably, can be found. But the technology has only developed recently. People think that, oh, Atlantis is just this city or continent or whatever, sitting on the bottom of the ocean, and you just get in a submarine, you look out the porthole, and there it is. That's not correct. Mm-hmm. It's a phenomenon known as deposition. And deposition is this. Organic materials fill the oceans. And when the organic materials rise to the surface, they flourish towards the surface, then they die. And when these organic materials die, they fall back from the surface of the ocean back to the floor of the ocean. And when they do that, they turn into silt and mud. Now, this process of deposition has been going on for Atlantis for 32 centuries, 3,200 years of organic rain that has been taking place from the surface of the ocean down to the bottom, the floor of the ocean. So that means that any ruins that are down there have been covered by 32 centuries of constant organic rain or deposition. It'd be the same thing as if you took Hiroshima, was destroyed by an atomic bomb only 70 years ago. And you take this, the ruins of Hiroshima, and you put it under the sea for 3,200 years. What would you find? What would be there to see at the bottom of the ocean of Hiroshima after 32 centuries? Not too much.
Right.
That's the same problem that is now facing the investigators of Atlantis, because it is not just sitting neatly in perfect pristine condition on the bottom of the sea. It is buried not only under miles of water, but also who knows how much collection, accumulation of silt and mud. And it has only been very recently that the technology exists, mostly low-frequency sonar, that enables us to look beneath the silt, although there's problems with that. So that's what I'm basically trying to do, is to get to marshal the technology that is only just now available, and it ain't cheap, let me tell you. Archaeology on land is expensive. Archaeology underwater is 3 times as expensive.
Hmm.
So it's a matter of money, and it's also a matter of technology. We may not actually even have the proper technology now to look for Atlantis. Perhaps we do at long last, maybe not. But until Atlantis is physically found, it will always be debatable, and I completely agree with that. Like I said, all the conclusions I've made about the reality of Atlantis may be incorrect, may be a misinterpretation of evidence. I don't think it is, but I'm trying to be a scientist. I'm trying to leave myself open to human error.
Mm-hmm.
But the technology exists, so we should go after it, and that's basically where I am right now.
Absolutely. Now, how did Plato find out about Atlantis?
Plato found out about Atlantis because of a very great Athenian lawmaker. His name was Solon, S-O-L-O-N. And around 600 B.C., in other words, about 2,600 years ago, Solon created the first laws for Athens. This is the first codified legislative system. He originated it, he put it in place, and then he allowed the Athenians to debate it. While they were debating it, he took a holiday. He went on vacation. And he went to, this is a matter of history now, this isn't me channeling or making up, this is established history. And so Solon and his colleagues left Athens for the Greeks to settle out their own interpretation of his laws. He went to on a tour of Egypt, and one of the places he went to Egypt was a place called Sais. That's the Greek name for it. Sais is this very old temple city in northern Egypt, or the Upper Nile Valley, and it was there that he went to a temple. And in this great temple, which really existed, they found remnants of it. It's unfortunate there's hardly anything survives. It was a great, magnificent temple. And in the center of this temple was a column, a pillar. And on the pillar was described in hieroglyphic language, in Egyptian hieroglyphs, the story of Atlantis. Now, Atlantis is a Greek term. It means the daughter of the mountain. In Egyptian, it was called Etalenti. And the chief priest of the temple at Sais, his name was Sanchus. He was the Egyptian high priest. And he translated the hieroglyphic text from ancient Egyptian into Greek for Solon. Solon took the transcription of this translation back with him to Athens after he completed his holiday, and was in the process of creating a kind of an epic that would describe the entire Atlantean history as he learned it in ancient Egypt. He passed away before he could complete that. The notes were preserved and passed down directly to Plato.
We're speaking with Frank Joseph. He's a wonderful author and researcher. He's contributed a chapter to this new book, Lost Secrets of the Gods. But if you go to Amazon.com and put in the name Frank Joseph, you'll find a host of books, and I can recommend them. They are outstanding. I've read several of his books. And we also have several of his interviews in our archive at FringeRadioNetwork.com. Now, Frank, one of the interesting things, and I've never forgotten this, in our past interviews, you've talked about lost, quote-unquote, lost archaeology here in the United States, civilizations that came here, and yet we've covered it up, or our government has, because for one reason, we might not want those people having a stake in our country, in parts of the land, as having come here first. Do you think there's any type of suppression with Atlantis?
Well, the only type of suppression is really quite understandable. Over the past, say, 150 years, there have been some really remarkably responsible investigators of Atlantis. They've done some mm-hmm. really great work. I'm thinking of a man way back was Ignatius Donnelly. He's among the most famous, the best known. He truly applied scientific principles to understanding Atlantis. This is back in the 1880s. He published his book, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, in 1882. There have been others since him. Unfortunately, there have been also researchers or investigators or fantasy makers that have associated Atlantis with all kinds of completely scientifically unacceptable materials.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, mainstream science or conventional science regards Atlantis as a laughable myth. And the reason why is because so much nonsense has been associated with Atlantis that very few researchers will openly discuss it. And that's unfortunate.
Now, as I understand it, if I remember right, several years ago, and it might have been in the 90s, it was discovered that there was something, I believe, north of Cuba under the water that looked like it was a city. Did they ever discover what that was?
What happened was you're referring to an underwater researcher by the name of Zielinski and her husband. This is back in the early part of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
They were hired by the Cuban government to look for oil. And in the process of looking for oil off Cuban waters, or not off, within Cuban waters rather, they found what appeared to be man-made structures. And these man-made structures looked remarkably similar to Mayan pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with these structures is that they were at very great depths. They were well over 10,000 feet underwater. And they were in pristine condition. It didn't look like there were ruins at all. So the question is, how is it possible, if in fact these are man-made structures, to be at something like, I forgot the exact depth, 10 or 12,000 feet. It was really far down. And we do know, as I said, that the Ice Age lowered the sea levels by almost 400 feet. But 400 feet is quite a ways off of 10 or 12,000.
Yeah.
How did these structures get down there? Did they, were they somehow part of some geological process that lowered them that we don't understand yet, that lowered them like an elevator to that depth? The sonar images that Zielinski was able to provide were provocative, were really interesting. If they were not man-made pyramids, what were they? Nothing has taken place since then, unfortunately, because, again, the costs involved. The Cuban government was not really particularly interested in pursuing it because Castro was interested in oil. He wasn't interested in Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
And Zielinski did not get the funding that was necessary for her to pursue this. And it's, like I said, it's very costly. So far as I understand, and my colleagues have tried to determine this also, what's been going on since then, is that all further investigations have come to nothing because they've not been allowed to pursue it as far as they'd like to go.
Hmm.
Now, are these images that we're seeing, are they really pyramids or are they something else? We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The images that were made were not photographs. They were taken with sonar, side-scan sonar, which can, in effect, take a kind of an image or a picture, if you want, with sonar, which a sonar signal is then received into a computer, and the computer sorts out the sonar image to turn it into a kind of a picture. And the picture certainly looks like a Mesoamerican pyramid. I wish I knew more about it. It's, my own feelings about it are that it may be authentic.
Hmm.
What we're looking at may be a pyramid city at the bottom of the sea off the coast of Cuba. If that's the case, that means that there is a geological process that we don't understand yet. How is it possible that such a structure could have gone that far down and still be intact?
Frank, as always, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for joining us this week.
Thank you so much, Bruce. I really appreciated your interesting and insightful questions.
Thank you.
Just to be clear, I see no evidence personally that Atlantis ever existed. Therefore, I do not believe in Atlantis. Nonetheless, we had two very interesting, engaging guests this week. One was Frank Joseph. This was actually an interview I did several years ago on Atlantis. And the other one was a brand new interview with Dennis Brooks regarding his book, Atlantis Pyramids Floods. Hope you enjoyed the program this week. The big finale will be back next week. And we hope you can join us then. Take care.